Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Anne Fadiman. Her book is The Wine Lover's Daughter. The wine lover in this case is Clifton Fadiman, who in his heyday was the host and interrogator on a quiz show called Information Please. He was also one of the primary judges of the Book of the Month Club. He was the example of the man that my parents told me I could not be. He was a man who made a very good living by being literary. And his daughter, Anne Fadiman, is one day younger than I am. And so we grew up with the same books, the same movies, the same literary influences, except you came from a literary family that was a little bit embarrassed to be Jewish, and I came from a non-literary family for whom being Jewish was everything.
Well, it's great to be here, Michael, and if either of us believed in astrology, we would be identical because we are essentially the same age, and I think we do have a tremendous amount in common.
A tremendous amount in common. Anne Fadiman was the teacher at Yale of one of my favorite young writers, a writer I hope I encouraged, who you all have heard on the show, Nadja Spiegelman, who wrote a book about her mother, Françoise, and it was the first book, the first memoir I ever did. You know, this show is devoted primarily to fiction and poetry, but I would say that Françoise's biography, from the point of view of her daughter, was a literary masterpiece, and the essays, the personal essays that Anne Fadiman writes are gems, are models of their kind. Now, you put them at the door of your love of Charles Lamb. And I was fascinated to read about Charles Lamb because I didn't know, all I knew were tales from Shakespeare. Whereas you've exposed to me a whole spectrum of essays, all of which begin on pork.
Yes, on this, on that, not the my current book. My current book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, is a memoir about my father, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute. But the previous one, At Large and At Small, is a collection of essays in a genre called familiar essays, which doesn't mean you've heard of them. It means that they are about familiar subjects written in a familiar conversational tone, but they also are personal essays that are about something. So Charles Lamb would write about difficult relatives, let's say, and he would tell us about his own experiences, but he'd also just expound on the topic. And I found that genre of personal essay perfect for me because I could talk about myself without being narcissistic every single moment. But Lamb, I have to say, is also a personal favorite because after I discovered his essays, I learned about his extraordinary life, his close relationship with a sister who went mad and murdered their mother. And instead of rebuffing her and never seeing her again,
They became collaborators
on Tales from Shakespeare. Absolutely amazing. So I find Lamb's life, and he was essentially an accountant, and To think of him working all day and then coming home to the sister and writing at night, he just breaks my
heart. Yes,
he
was a scrivener like Bartleby.
Yes, he was.
And I've got news for you, Anne Fetterman. Your new book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, which is published by the wonderful Farrah Straus and Giroux, is also a personal essay. You're calling it a memoir, but it's secretive. You see, the real subject of this book is not the wine lover, but the wine lover's daughter. And the wine lover's daughter did not grow up loving wine, and her father, the wine lover, Clifton Fadiman, was not ashamed to say that he loved wine and reading more than any person, place, or thing. My parents never told me that they loved anything more than they loved me. And so, you know, they may not have been literary, but they didn't fool me about their affections. Your desire, nearly lifelong, to love wine the way your father did, to discover that you just don't, there was a reason, a genetic reason, that wine was not for you. Now, how do you say the word? Papillae.
Papillae, the taste buds on the tongue. And if you have a lot of them, your taste is so sensitive that wine tastes too strong. I also discovered I have the genetic variant that makes me especially sensitive to bitterness in alcohol. But let me back up a minute, because when you said, well, your parents made it clear that they didn't love anything more than they loved you, my father loved us enormously. It was just that the kind of sacredness of wine and books was in a category of, he was a very a-religious man, but I'll say that it's biblical in order to give you the sense of its magnitude and sacredness. Wine and books were so large and important and beautiful and almost tear-inducing for him that no mere mortal could come close.
Now tell me, were you ever jealous of wine?
Ha! I was never jealous of wine, but I did feel inadequate because I couldn't love it. It was as if in our family I had been unable to love literature. Of course, I had no problem with that. But for much of my life, it was as if I was missing a sense that somehow made me incapable of appreciating great art or great music. And, of course, I was able to appreciate those things. But my lack of appreciation for wine was, in my father's view, almost a character flaw. So after spending my entire life feeling that there was something missing in me, a deficiency that maybe I would be able to compensate for if I just tried wine enough, I finally decided, well, maybe it's biology. And this came to me accidentally. I was talking with a friend, and the friend brought up cilantro.
Which, as an Easterner, I came out to the West Coast where cilantro was king. Cotton is king in the South. Cilantro is king in Los Angeles cooking.
Do you like cilantro?
I can't stand it.
Okay, so you and I are, not only are we exactly the same age, we are bonded forever in cilantrophobia. So the dislike of cilantro is at least partially genetic. This has been discovered quite recently. The hilarious thing was that this happened right after I had, at a close friend's house, had drunk with some other guests a bottle of Aubryon, which is one of the greatest Bordeaux's in the world. It's not that I hate wine, but clearly it was not making the same kind of impact on me as it was on the other guests. I even left a little in my glass.
Half inch, you say?
Half inch, which my father, oh gosh, he would have rolled over in his grave if he hadn't been cremated. So the notion that the various things that these other people, the tasting notes for Aubryon that I looked up after, oh, it's like a cedar in a sauna, or it's like lavender, or it's like pencil shavings. It's like, those meant nothing. I couldn't taste any of those. So I thought, gosh, could wine, I knew it wasn't going to be as simple as cilantro, but could there be something about my biology that could make me, unlike my father, unable to appreciate wine? And I took a bunch of tests, and I don't know whether it was happy or sad, but the answer was
fascinating.
That there was.
I'm talking with Anne Fadiman about her book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. There are taste scientists.
Yes.
One at Cornell. You know, one of the pleasures of personal essay writing is you get to characterize the people you would otherwise only describe.
Oh,
and
good.
So this woman is saying,
hate it.
She's a wine hater too. And she's very great. She sets you up with tapas and things to taste. And within minutes, she knows exactly what you're going to like. Not green peppers, but red peppers and yellow peppers are
exactly
fine.
She had me pegged. Her name is Virginia Uttermolen. And she was marvelous. She's a taste scientist. She's a former professor of nutrition at Cornell, whose specialty is why people like and dislike the foods they like and dislike. And she looks like a taste scientist. She's round with a big smile and pink cheeks.
The Wine Lover's Daughter is a particularly fascinating book because the wine loving is the hidden subject of the book. The real subject of the book is growing up with a truly literary father who managed to figure out how to make a living out of reading. Now, whenever I do public speaking, there's some grandmother who comes up to me and says, "Can you help me? My grandson loves to read, and I don't know what to tell him." And I always say, "Don't scare him. If you have the money to be supportive of him, be patient. There are jobs. He will find them. There's no such thing as passionate love for a subject that doesn't finally get fulfilled. It got fulfilled in my case. It got fulfilled in your, Anne Fadiman's, case. And the interesting thing is that in addition to the wine loving, there's the subject here of Judaism. Now, your father, Clifton Fadiman, dreamed of crossing the river, which in his case meant
going from Brooklyn to Manhattan. So my father was born in 1904 in Brooklyn. His parents were Russian Jewish immigrants, and he lived over a series of failed drugstores run by his father in various neighborhoods in Brooklyn. He shared a bed with his two brothers. There was never any money. The streets outside were noisy. His parents spoke ungrammatical and accented English.
Yes, and I had one that I read which might have come from my aunt. Have a piz fruit.
Yes, that's right. That's what his relatives would say.
Have a piz fruit.
You say it perfectly with that Yiddish accent. And of course, that's not what he wanted to have. He did not want to have the piz fruit. So he went to Boys High in Brooklyn. So one of the poignant things that I discovered while researching this book was that his elder brother, Ed, had been the vice president of the Correct English Club at Boys High.
No.
And the poignance, and I actually found it in the yearbook. I got to know the librarian of, now they've joined with Girls High, and she dug out these old yearbooks, and I wouldn't have believed it myself. The Correct English Club, composed entirely of boys who didn't want to sound like their parents. Doesn't that just break your heart?
It breaks my heart, but it's also fascinating to me because Cynthia Ozick once explained to me that there she was, the child of immigrants, in a Brooklyn high school, and what do they read? They who have no English in their background, they whose parents come from Russia, they read Ivanhoe.
Exactly.
And it's "Prithee, fair maiden."
Right.
All around. "Prithee, fair maiden, wouldst thou," etc. And that's not English either. Or it's a sort of sub-Shakespearean invention of Walter Scott's.
Well, my father's voice was an invention, too, not of Walter Scott's. At Boys High, the drama coach also had an elocution class. And so he took these boys with their Brooklyn accents, with their immigrant parents, and taught them to pronounce words so impeccably that no one actually speaks like that except other people from Brooklyn who wish to sound as if they don't. And that was his famous radio voice, which convinced many people who didn't know his background that he was a sort of a Mayflower descendant because he sounded as far from Brooklyn as anyone could possibly imagine.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Anne Fadiman about her book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Anne Fadiman about her latest book, The Wine Lover's Daughter, an unflinching look at the author's father through a wine glass. Well, what's fascinating to me is that we're living in a time, and you're teaching in a time, you're teaching personal essay writing at Yale University, where we are no longer teaching our immigrants and their children not to want to be who they are, not to want to speak the languages they speak. It is very important to tell your own story now. We didn't have that luxury, and so frequently, I'll bet it's true for you too. Tell me if it's true. When you wrote an essay with the assigned subject, the most memorable person I ever met, did you invent him?
No, because I was never assigned that subject. but I might have invented him. Did you invent him when you got that assignment?
I invented him. Like your father inventing an accent, I invented myself from the shelves of the library.
Just the way he did. So even though you and I are exactly the same age, you and my father were the ones who had the similar backgrounds. But the difference is that your parents embraced their Jewish roots, whereas my father wished to cut them off. My father wanted to get the hell out of Brooklyn. When he got over to Columbia, where there were all of these WASP professors with, you know, triple names, he looked at them carefully, like an anthropologist, or perhaps like an actor studying the Strasbourg method. He wanted to sound like them, act like them, be like them. And the saddest part was that although that was helpful for his career, it meant that he became very ashamed of his parents.
And not only that, you see, there he is at Columbia University, and one of his best friends and fellow students is Lionel Trilling. And at that time, they actually could say to you, call you in and say to you, we have room for only one Jew in the graduate school, and that one is going to be Lionel Trilling.
Well, he was already in the graduate school. They were both in the master's program, having both been, they were best friends in the class of 25 at Columbia, went on to graduate school. My father had been there for about a year when the chair of the English department called him in and said that. And of course, you might say, well, okay, so Columbia wasn't going to hire him. He could have gone and worked at City College, but he felt so rebuffed, so shocked that he was unable to continue. He simply dropped out of graduate school and became himself, someone who was in many ways vastly more successful than Lionel Trilling. In his day, he was more famous. He was certainly wealthier. And Lionel envied him tremendously, but I think not as much as he envied Lionel.
Well, you know, this is not a story that came to an end with your father's generation. One of my absolutely beloved teachers was a brilliant journalist. In fact, he didn't want to be called a scholar. He thought that academia had ruined culture in America. But he told me, Michael, you must change your name. Your name is too narrowly ethnic.
Wow.
We were told things like this. You know, he said, you will be a successful literary person. Please do not become an academic. Be a literary journalist like me, but change your name. It was really something you didn't have to do because Fadiman isn't inscribed as a Jewish name.
No. I mean, when you think of my father's friends like George Novak, who started off as Yosef Mendel Novograbelsky, or Felix Morrow, who was Felix Meyerowitz, and Diana Trilling tells the story of the Columbia philosophy professor who made a rather pointed comment about Morrow's distinguished last name, and Morrow said cheerfully, well, I wouldn't know about that. I'm the first in my family to bear it. But Fadiman was not a shortened or anglicized last name. I happen to know this because a cousin of mine hired a researcher in Minsk to go back and find out a little bit about the Fadiman genealogy. And for four generations, all of my ancestors were named either Fadiman or Fadiman, which of course are simply different transliterations of exactly the same name from the Cyrillic. So there was no need to change a name. But my father, of course, was enormously happy because he felt that his Jewishness was an albatross. He wished to leave it as far behind as possible. And the fact that he had a name that some people might imagine as a WASP name, even the name of a WASP descendant, whereas, you're stuck with Silverblatt. Of course, you could have changed it, and I'm so glad that you didn't. But my father probably would have changed it if his last name had been Silverblatt.
Well, how do you feel about your father's identity shame?
It makes me sad, and I should make clear that this book, which is about the arc of my father's life, the cost, I guess, of his upward mobility, all that it gave him, but also the residue of social embarrassment and shame and the sense of being counterfeit and just acting and
you say this in the book, but I thought to myself, you know, there's a certain thing. At that time, let's bear in mind, we're edging toward the 60s. The fact that he's earning money and earning a nice living sometimes was cause for shame. When everyone was proud of not earning money, of trying to find a literary life that was not a capitalist life.
That wasn't the message I got from him. He wanted to make money. He was interested in money. He was proud of money. He kept accounts. He had sort of price tags on his wine bottles. He loved making money. But his parents had predicted that he would never be able to make a living because all he could do was read. So he parlayed the ability to read into becoming the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster when he was 28 and the book reviewer for The New Yorker when he was 29. He held both of those jobs simultaneously for a while.
Wow.
But that sense of shame, just to sort of get back to your question, the book, I think, is a loving book, but it reveals a lot of very uncomfortable things about my father. I didn't feel it was worthwhile spending years trying to understand him if I didn't look at his flaws as intently as I looked at his virtues. And
I love the mixture.
Well, he was a
mixture. Accuracy and love.
Ah.
And I do. And I
thank
also, you do not feel necessarily jealous of the wine, but I feel jealous of you. You see, I grew up without parents who knew, so my mother would call me, Michael, there's someone named Pauline Kael on the phone, or Michael, Donald Barthelme is calling you. And your father would have said, oh, Anne, where did you meet them? How exciting for you. My parents had no idea. They'd yell, Michael, it's supper time. Hang up the phone.
That's exactly what my father's parents would have said if he had been hanging out with the equivalent of Donald Barthelme and Pauline Kael in his day. But yes, so we had my father with his two brothers inventing these sort of new literary kind of fake patrician, completely assimilated selves and leaving the past behind. And then you have my father trying to raise his children as non-invented patricians who were surrounded by the kind of literary atmosphere he had created for himself,
and
rather
wine.
Than been bequeathed. And wine. And boy, we ate up the books, but we didn't eat up the wine.
Well, it's interesting because wine becomes, what is that crazy word they use nowadays? Synecdoche.
Yes.
For aristocracy.
Right.
And you are an aristocrat because by the age of 8 or 10, you know your Bordeaux. You may not like to drink them. You know your white wines go in a tall, fluted glass. Your
red wines
go in a bold glass. And you are ready to take your place among the aristocrats. So let me tell you, Anne Fadiman, you have taken your place among the aristocrats of nonfiction writing.
Thank you.
There's a great beauty of the intimacy, both in the essays and in this. You say a memoir. I think it's a sneaky book about wine, class, literary consciousness, and how we've come to a new America. I think it's a very exciting book. It's called The Wine Lover's Daughter. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it's by my guest, Anne Fadiman. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael. This has been a fascinating conversation.
What fun, really. I've been talking with Anne Fadiman, author of The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Wine Lover's Daughter at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. And special thanks to Sean Sullivan, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when we revisit Colson White.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.